My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare, the Battle of Ideas. Anthony Brink, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
It's great to be here, Germ.
What is your backstory? What is your bio?
Well, I trained and qualified as a lawyer, and I've practiced law for decades. Prosecutor, criminal magistrate, civil magistrate, bar for many years, regional court magistrate, and but my life took an unexpected turn when, and I remember it as clear as day, like yesterday, on the last Sunday of September 1996, I stumbled onto a website which a number of dissident critiques of the HIV theory of AIDS were posted, and these included critical writing about the drug AZT. And at the time, our government was under tremendous pressure from the world's then biggest drug corporation, pharmaceutical corporation, GlaxoSmithKline. Well, GlaxoWelcome became GlaxoSmithKline later. It was under tremendous pressure to spend billions of its health budget on buying this drug, 3-azido-3-doxythymidine, or zidovudine, or AZT, for administration to pregnant African women, supposedly to protect their unborn babies from being infected by them. So they'd be born into the world, you know, free of HIV because of this life-saving wonder drug. And I discovered, to my stunned amazement, that this drug was really shit. It was like pure poison, like extremely toxic and utterly useless. It was indeed designed to kill human cells. And also, it didn't have the pharmacological action claimed by its manufacturer. So, I don't take aspirin, but I mean, I understand that aspirin can take your headache away. So, you know, you take aspirin, and the benefit is that you lose your headache. But the cost is that it's got a number of significant side effects. You know, it's harmful on your gut. It's actually contraindicated for children under 16, because it can cause neurological damage. Believe it or not, it's in the package insert that you can see in the box that you buy from the Pick and Pay. It's got a benefit. Aspirin may have an arguable benefit, but it's also got a risk, whereas the cost benefit ratio in the case of AZT is infinite. It's all risk, all harm, and no benefit. So I found this very interesting, and I began looking into it, and contacting people who were agitating about this stuff. And very quickly, I acquired this reputation internationally as that guy who's onto this and who's agitating and interested and concerned by this. And it was so extraordinary. I'd wake up in the morning and check my email, and I'd just be flooded by emails from around the world, medical professionals, journalists, lay activists. I'd be flooded with emails to which the latest medical papers were attached. So what I did was I started, systematizing all that data. I would extract, glean the nub of each paper and start working it into a manuscript. And I was quite alone, practicing law, minding my own business, and I just had this like irresistible imperative. Something had to be done. So I began preparing this information, synthesizing all this literature, as it were, pulling it all together. And I then thought, well, what must I do? I'm all alone. I have, politically, so to speak, I have no contacts, no useful connections. So I thought, I must engage our country's best, sharpest investigative journalist, in my opinion, Martin Vels of Newsweek. So I wrote to him, didn't hear from him. And six months later, he contacted me through his deputy editor at the time. And long and the short of it was that I was asked to write 5,000 words. It was the biggest space allocation in the history of his journal, I heard later. In a hurry, so I perfected what I'd written about AZT, and I wrote some other stuff and I submitted it. In the result, he didn't use that then. He published later, I mean, sort of more introductory material. But I was sitting with this AZT essay I wrote called AZT and Medicine from Hell. And I thought, you know, this can't sit around. It's terribly important. I mean, our country's under tremendous pressure our government's under tremendous pressure to buy this stuff. And it's like a desperate, desperately poisonous, useless drug. It's like a crisis. So I sent it to all the newspapers, and of all the newspapers imaginable, I mean, most unexpected, the Citizen picked up on it and published it. And then our country's top treatment expert, so to say, Dr. Des Martin, the chairperson of the HIV/AIDS Clinician Society, he answered it in the same newspaper, and then I replied. And then shortly, it was like the heavens opened, and a whole lot of literature was published in the medical and scientific press about this bad drug. So I kind of tore the seams of this quilt apart, and I stuffed the new papers in, as it were, and I sent the whole shit up to government. And I sent it up to the health minister, and it was received by the special advisor, Dr. Ian Roberts, who said, clearly you know more about this drug than anybody in the country, which was true. He says, but let me hang on. Let me not give it to Susanna Zuma, health minister at the time under Mandela. Let's see whether Mbeki, who's coming in a month or two, June, 1999. Let's see whether he keeps it on or changes his cabinet around. Well, as it turns out, he did. He brought Dr. Chabalala Msimang in as health minister and moved, of course, Susanna Zuma to foreign affairs. So he passed it on to her, confirmed he'd done so. And again, to compress the story, the thing reached Mbeki. And on the 28th of October, 1999, you know, I'm standing in my kitchen, and after a hard day in court and all that, and here comes the news. Today, President Thabo Mbeki announced in the National Council of Provinces that it's been brought to our attention that there's a large volume of scientific evidence that the drug AZT is a danger to human health, and it would be grossly irresponsible for our government to disregard the dire warnings these researchers have been making. And it's also been brought to our attention that there's some litigation pending, and I've ordered my health minister to look into it. So in an instant, since nobody else in the country, to my knowledge, was working on this problem, I knew that my staff had reached him. And indeed, following day, Smatsun Gonyama, who was Director General of the Presidency, called me for further information. And a day or so after that, Kgalema Motlanthe, the ANC Secretary General, contacted me through his secretary for more information still. And I was asked to assist draw the ANC's press release. And, you know, that's where the trouble started. You know, the next thing, my name kind of got out. And, you know, I was inundated by international journalists, you know, teaming in and around my house. I mean, it was amazing. It's like in the movies, you know. You know, with a van outside and a dish. And, you know, I'm exaggerating, but it was like that sense of things. And I was interviewed, you know, numerous times, and also sailed in all the media and so forth. I just want to say, for what it's worth, that, you know, it was never about me. And even though you've asked me to tell my tale, it was always the issue, not about me. So all these years I've resisted writing a book about it, you know, tell your story, because I always felt... I always felt, you know, well, who cares? And I don't care. It's
yeah, you say, Anthony, that it's not about you and it's about the issue. Yeah. And the issue is that HIV does not cause AIDS. That was the claim that Mbeki made. And as it turns out, he was correct.
No, incorrect. He never made that claim. And in fact, he twice I've got the references. I can't recall offhand, but he twice repudiated the charge that he stated HIV doesn't cause AIDS. Now, you may say that's a bit tricky or disingenuous, because certainly he didn't, at that by that time, any longer believe in the HIV theory of AIDS. But the reason for his dissent from the HIV theory of AIDS was much more profound than the Duisbergian position that HIV doesn't cause AIDS because it's a harmless passenger virus, etc. And Berge, from an early point, understood very well that HIV, in inverted commas, had never been proven to exist, which sounds preposterous. But what can I say? If you look into it, you'll discover that the evidence is wanting. And in fact, the evidence is wanting for the whole of virology. The virology is just complete horseshit, you know. It doesn't stand up. So Berge understood that. He never said HIV doesn't cause AIDS, because he didn't want to imply or allow that HIV exists. He understood. And by the way, I'm not talking just, you know, through my hat here. And Berge is the principal author of a very important monograph submitted to the ANC NEC for discussion in April, I think 2001 or 2002, somewhere around there. It's called the Castro Hlongwane, cats, geese, etc., and the, you know, the dehumanization of the African or something like that. But anyway, I've got the extended version, the revised and extended version of that monograph. It's on my website. Just search for Castro at the website tig.org.za. And in that monograph, Mbeki discusses, he canvasses the problem with HIV, in inverted commas. He makes the point clearly, unambiguously, that HIV has never been isolated. You know, I know that your audience is hip, because you've had all sorts of people on your show who have dealt with this stuff, so this shouldn't be too shocking. But, you know, I'm fond of analogies, and I'm fond of historical precedents, and I'm fond of pointing up the fact that historically, all sorts of notions have been universally accepted, which have been completely vacant. For example, at one time in European culture, English, Scottish, and Irish, European culture, I mean, the belief in witchcraft was universal. You had no less than three witchcraft acts, you know, passed by the English Parliament. And, you know, tens of thousands of people in England, in the United Kingdom, and Europe, were duly, also New America, you know, sorry, New England, in the Massachusetts and so on, Salem. Tens of thousands of people were duly tried on what is regarded as good evidence by courts of law, and sentenced to death and hanged, you know, for making, you know, hellish league with the devil, you know, with Satan, you know, all that stuff. Today we know it's a joke, it's ridiculous. But everybody believed at that time in the existence of evil spirits and witches familiars and imps, you know. They all had fancy names, you know, like Dandy and Fancy and Grizzle and Greedy Nut and Illimacar and Peck Pie Wacket and Peck in the Crown, you know, and all these pictures, you know, very impressive graphics in the encyclopedias, including an encyclopedia, by the way, by King James in England, published in 1600, called Demonology. You know, this was high science in its day. And none other than Lord Chief Justice Anderson, the brightest, biggest, brightest, best lawyer in England, you could say, said in 1602, the land is full of witches. They're bound in all places. And I'm paraphrasing now, without firm and prompt action taken against them. And hey, here's what he said. They will soon overrun the land, you know. And he went on to say that he's hanged, you know, 26 or 27 of them himself, you know. So I mention this because this belief in HIV/AIDS and the belief in viruses, which seems so scientific and clever and sophisticated, it's just all superstition. You know, when you drill down, you discover it's all bullshit. You know,
it's like a cult.
Yeah, it's a cult, but it's also it has to do with it's also a mass hysterical phenomenon. You know, a grand popular delusion. You know?
But then, Anthony, yeah. how is it that Thabo Mbeki realized this, but nobody around him did? How is it that he was an island?
Yeah, that's not hard to explain. It's because the dissident voices were so few and so low that they simply hadn't reached him. I mean, very few people had heard of Peter Duisberg, who was like the most provident, Professor Peter Duisberg, the most prominent AIDS dissident in the world, best known. Much less had folk heard of Eleni Papadopoulos, this
from the Perth group.
Yes, at the Royal Perth Hospital. I mean,
She died last year, I think.
Yeah. Terrible. She died of old age. She was old and ill. But you know, really, we lost the Nicholas Copernicus of molecular biology. And I say that, you know, I don't mean to sound extravagant or hyperbolic, but really, that woman, she was so clever. You know, when I used to read her stuff, it read to me, it sung, you know, like a Bach fugue. You know, it was so intelligent, so interesting. You know? I was very close to Eleni, certainly when the thing began. I would speak to her once or twice a month, you know, long phone calls, you know, regular phone calls. We were very close. Not only was I championing her position on HIV, and of course, AZT, because she wrote a huge paper on the molecular pharmacology of AZT, but also what's not widely known was that there was a very severe, harsh, merciless civil war among the dissidents for quite some time, and we were very divided. And I confess, without any shame, that I was the leading belligerent in this thing. I was the most intolerant, cruel, divisive, and hated radical in the radical camp.
In what way?
Camp. I mean, those who contend, there is no HIV. And we were very strong in insisting that we were the minority, but we were very determined. We were very strong on the importance of adopting the correct scientific strategy. If you watch that cool film, The Young Karl Marx, now I'm not a Marxist anymore, but if you watch that cool film, The Young Karl Marx, you'll see, you appreciate how much energy was put into establishing the correct line. Because in small subversive groups, it's all important to It's all important that your spear or your blade should be maximally sharp as possible. If you stick your sword in at the wrong angle and it's dull, you're not going to, you know, you've got less of a chance. You know what I mean? So it was very important for us to adopt the correct line, to argue truthfully, and not argue this bullshit that Peter Duisberg was arguing, that HIV is a harmless passenger virus. Because we contended, it's like going around saying, you're nothing to fear from virus from vampires. They're friendly guys. They lurk around the back of a tree at night, you know, but they don't have any teeth, you know. So don't fear vampires. You know? We think it's a futile, it's doomed to fail. It's a futile way of attacking the belief in vampires, which is also at one time ubiquitous and believed by everybody.
Wasn't that position by Duisberg held also by people like Carrie Mudis or Judy Mikovits, for example, also? So in other words, HIV is there, but it's harmless.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm sure she's a very nice person, but and actually I know she suffered as well. But, you know, I don't regard her as a great scientific luminary. Duisberg is a hell of an interesting guy. He's a very likable guy. I've spent time with him. He's very funny, very witty, amusing, charming, you know. But he's just hung up on this notion that HIV, he won't actually address the problem. He's been debated, and he won't come to grips with the problem. The problems in the position that HIV is a harmless passenger virus.
Yeah, Luc Montagnier, I think Luc Montagnier also started backpedaling on that in the last 5 years before he died. Mm. And he won the Nobel Prize for supposedly isolating it.
Sure did. I met him. Yeah. I met him when I introduced himself and I explained my kind of political role in the controversy. You know, he kind of stepped back. He was a bit alarmed, you know. I think he sensed that there could be trouble coming. But anyway, yeah, I have an interview. How can I put it? I've got a DVD. I've got two DVDs on which an interview with Montagnier is recorded, where he admits that despite a Roman effort, his researchers couldn't find in the so-called purification any objects with the typical morphology of retroviruses. In other words, if we imagine that an imp or some demonic form has, you know, cloven hooves and horns and, you know, looks like a goat and funny tail and all that, you know, if we go looking for that thing and we don't find it, then we are bound to say we couldn't find it when we did the experiment. Again, I'm speaking analogically. That's pretty much what he conceded. He conceded on video that he never found any virus. Nonetheless, he made the claim. And that, of course, the claim's been picked to pieces by the Perth group, Eleni Papadopoulos, Iliopoulos. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Take me back to Tom and Becky. I'm still fascinated by how he was absolutely destroyed. So here was this lone man, and he still referenced this in his book, A Dream Deferred. And he...
That's Gevisser's book, yeah? Mark Gevisser, yeah?
Yeah. But about Mbeki.
Mark Gevisser wrote the biography. Yeah. I met Gevisser too, yeah.
And Mbeki was wondering, how is it that the people that he helped liberate were suddenly now being destroyed by a virus that was only interested in gay men in American nightclubs and poor black people in Africa?
Yeah. Spot on. Look, Mbeki's story in this thing, Mbeki's, the history of Mbeki's engagement is also terribly interesting. You see, Mbeki has this reputation, and he's been very damaged by this reputation for being the world's most reviled AIDS denialist, you know, dissident denialist, whatever. But what's not remembered well is that actually Mbeki began as a real, you know, happy clappy, as a real, you know, revival tent preacher. I was just looking at my manuscript on the whole history, this 1,000-page job, which I have to finish one day. And I was reminded that Edwin Cameron, in February 1996, was lobbying Mandela to start getting involved and start making the required fuss about this all, you see? And a meeting was set up, but Mandela didn't show. February 1996, yeah. Mandela didn't show. Mbeki did. And Cameron recalled later in a newspaper article how pumped up Mbeki was by this thing. You know, in all his language, by the way, I've captured everything he ever said about this. All his language was very enthusiastic, you know, about this plague and, you know, all those cliches. You know, Mbeki used them all. Anyway, Cameron reported how he was very enthusiastic and, you know, he gave him a hug, and Cameron explained that, or he recalled later that he really, really cared, you know. You know, in October 1998, which is a year before he blew the whistle, as it were, on AZT. Mbeki, none other than Mbeki, established the AIDS partnership, the partnership on AIDS, something like that. Yeah, this was an enormous endeavor, bringing people from all walks and all sectors in. It was a very big deal, you know. And he gave this speech, again, full of the conventional language. I have it from the late Professor Sam Mthongo that Mbeki feels foolish about how he was sucked in and duped, you know, gulled by all this garbage, you know, this enthusiasm, the stupid popular enthusiasm. But anyway, the point is that the record, when Mbeki blew the whistle, as it were, he called attention to the toxicity of AZT on the 28th of October, 1999, in the National Council of Provinces. But just in June, a few months earlier, you're still sporting a red AIDS ribbon on his tit. You know, he's really into it. So I find that an interesting, by the way, just as Mbeki believed and was pumping this thing, at that time, Mandela wouldn't step up. I mean, to the chagrin of all the activists and all these people, Mandela wasn't coming forward. He wasn't making the required noise. And he explained himself later. He said, you know, we Africans, we have a conservative approach to sex. We don't talk about it, and which is, by the way, perfectly valid, you know. But as Mbeki moved from fired up believer into apostasy, you know, into like a lapsed Catholic, as it were. Mandela went in the opposite direction, and Mandela became the kind of the AIDS mascot for all these journalists, stupid journalists and activists, you know. So that is also an interesting aspect of the early history, which is forgotten. You know, I find it curious, very interesting.
So. What you're suggesting then is that Mbeki also became isolated even within the ANC. Now, was he the only one? Was he the only one who knew that HIV didn't exist?
No. Very good question. Very pertinent question. No. Someone else who understood very well that HIV had never been isolated is Kgalema Motlanthe. And I quote his exact words, and on two different occasions he dealt with this problem. If you go to the top of the TIG.org.za website, there's a TIG position statement on HIV, and you click on that at the very top of the page, and then you read down, and then I quote Motlanthe. So Motlanthe was hip. I understand that others too. I don't embarrass them, but I know of others. I know of another very prominent national politician. Dr. Chabalala Msamang never, ever addressed the existence of HIV. I don't recall that she even addressed the HIV controversy, but she was very big on the toxicity of AZT.
She was ridiculed for the potatoes and garlic and all that stuff.
Yeah, for Christ's sake. I mean, she was advocating, as a Minister of Health, she was advocating for nutrient-rich foodstuffs, you know, like a root vegetable like beetroot, olive oil, garlic. I mean, these foods are well known to be very nutritious, but, you know, she was ridiculed. I mean, Zapira was ruthless in lampooning her in all his cartoons. It was the most stupid thing to say, that these foods, just mentioned foods, might be a way to recover one's health if ill. You know?
I was part of that ridicule, and I regret it now, in hindsight. But hindsight is a bitch, isn't it?
you know, the ARV rollout preceded Zuma's succession of Mbeki. Mbeki, as the head of state, was simply swept aside by the forces, you know, arrayed against him. And in no time at all, our country had the biggest ARV rollout program in the world. You know, from being a holdout, I mean, all Mbeki did, all he achieved, I mean, to his credit, because he couldn't do any more. Such was the balance of forces. All Mbeki did was he delayed the introduction of these ARVs into the health system for several months. But it was during his tenure as president that the rollout was ramped up. So I wouldn't blame Zuma for it. Zuma spoke consistently in an orthodox manner. He was simply uninformed, you know. But hey, I was uninformed when I was sitting in the bar common room, you know, regaling my advocate colleagues with stories about how, you know, AIDS is going to wipe everybody out, and soon there'll be these, soon there'll be like these feral orphans, you know, running around the streets, and we'll be stepping over dead bodies. My oath, I literally spoke it. I remember speaking that way because I had heard this, and I bought it. That's absurd, but you know, I just didn't know any better.
The irony, though, is his comments about showering after sex were probably not all that inaccurate.
Completely. There's nothing wrong with it. Of course, the notion that by having a shower, you won't fall ill with AIDS, that's ridiculous. But clearly, Zuma didn't internally really believe. He didn't really believe that that HIV causes AIDS, and that you can get sick with AIDS from having sex with someone, which is itself a preposterous idea. Which, by the way, brings me on to syphilis, if you want to talk about that, because that's also a terribly interesting story. And before I get there, I've got a couple of props for your show here. I've got this little bottle of AZT, okay? You can see it next to my little finger here. That gives you the dimensions, yeah? The tiny bottle, it contains 25 milligrams of AZT, 3-azido-3-doxythymidine. AZT, azidothymidine, right? I'm reading. Toxic, you know, on an orange stripe, like you see on the side of a tanker, you know, containing a hazardous chemical on the highway. The toxic in six different languages, and the following warning in black and white here. Toxic. Toxic by inhalation, in contact with skin, and if swallowed. Target organs, blood, bone marrow. Case of accident, or if you feel unwell, seek medical advice. Show the label where possible. Wear suitable protective clothing. I mean, that's 25 milligrams. I mean, it's a tiny amount. On the other hand, this is AZT produced, sold by Sigma Aldrich Chemical Company for experimental use in laboratories to give, you know, rats and so on. But here, I've got a bottle here of AZT for human ingestion. And I mean, here's a single capsule. It contains 100 milligrams, yeah? And you're supposed to take between 20 and 60 times the amount of AZT contained in this bottle every single day. I mean, it's just, it's ridiculous. I mean, the terrifying hazard warnings on a bottle. I mean, don't even open the lid unless you cover up completely, you know? But, you know, pregnant women are supposed to swallow this stuff. The crimes of the pharmaceutical industry are just...
That's what I wanted to ask you. When Zuma, for example, celebrated the rollout, that there was obviously pharmaceutical interest. I mean, that's where all the stuff came from. So there was obviously a narrative being driven behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Was there some sort of tension, some sort of conflict happening with Mbeki and the same actors?
Yeah, I mean, Mbeki was obstructing their business agenda. So it got as bad as Bill Clinton declaring AIDS in Africa a threat to the national security of the United States of America. And when Mbeki in 2000, I think April or May, went to the US. He was repeatedly warned, and Frank Ciccone records this in one of his books. I think, yeah. Frank Ciccone records that Mbeki was repeatedly warned that, you know, his very life was in danger for taking on these powers. So, yeah, there was it was all about profit making by the multinational pharmaceutical industry, in particular GlaxoSmithKline, in the countries of the South. And South Africa was regarded as a portal market, and here Mbeki was getting in the way. And so he was warned off. Not that he wimped out.
Outplayed.
He was persuaded to step down, stand back, as you say in law, step by the party was becoming too severe. And after all, Mbeki had other agendas, and this was a minor agenda in relation to the bigger political agendas.
How is it possible that so many people within the ANC bought into the HIV narrative?
It's easy. It's because they just didn't know any different. I mean, if you tell the same story by every newspaper, by every television station, day after day, you have no reason. You know, all these, you know, talking heads, they all seem very important and very knowledgeable. You have no reason to doubt the integrity of the story you've been told. It was the same as this COVID horseshit, you know. It was like saturation cover in all the media, all by these stupid journalists, you know. So, you know, very few people doubted it. You know what it's like. I know what it's like.
And then Thabo Mbeki kind of went quiet for a number of years, and then he spoke again earlier this year.
In 2016, bro. In 2016 also, yeah.
And then this year, Dunisa, and he was totally obliterated by the media and even the ANC.
Yeah. Well, what do you want to know? I mean, yeah, it's because this is like the rail that you mustn't touch. You see, the HIV AIDS and the wonder of these drugs, they've assumed a kind of a quasi-religious status or quality. But, so like, you mustn't touch that stuff.
But what I don't get, what I don't understand, Anthony, is if you were a black leader like Mbeki, and you saw that there was this ridiculous narrative that was targeting black people pretty much only, right? How is it that other black leaders saw this as absolutely acceptable? It's just so strange to me.
Mbeki answered that question you posed. He answered it by saying, in order to understand a subject, it is necessary to study it. And I know that Mbeki indeed studied this subject very intensively. He studied it particularly intensively over the period November, December, January, 1999-2000, the turn of the century. So he, you know, he read all the Perth Group papers. Interestingly enough, I know this, I can divulge it now. When he convened his international AIDS advisory panel, remind me to talk about the problems with that thing later. But when he convened his AIDS panel in, he moved on it in February, and it was actually held in May 2000. But when he had these things, had these meetings, at the second meeting, the Perth Group came, Eleni Papadopoulos Iliopoulos and Val Turner. And interestingly enough, he met them. He had a private audience with them, you know, and they reported in detail to me what happened.
I think David Resnick was there too.
David Resnick did not meet Mbeki. Mbeki had no interest whatsoever in meeting the Duisburg crowd.
Oh, was he part of that crowd?
He only had eyes. Yeah. No, Resnick has to come around. Again, remind me. Resnick is a great guy. I'm very fond of Dave Resnick. He's a cool guy. But Dave Resnick was very close to Duisburg. And he was one of the harmless passenger virus advocates, champions, proponents. But But the point is that Mbeki only wanted to meet and talk to Eleni and Val Turner, Eleni Papadopoulos and Val Turner, the birth group. So Mbeki was tuned into the problem that, the problem with HIV/AIDS being, there is no virus. You know, it's like the foundation stone of the building. It's like a hollow, it's like a hole, you know. Things very unstable. Now you say hijacked. What did you have in mind by hijacked? Because I can tell you what happened there and why I nearly didn't go. But here's the thing. The idea of this meeting was conceived by Eleni Papadopoulos, Iliopoulos, and it was expressed in an article by Val Turner, her, you could say, amanuensis, her sidekick, her assistant, her close supporter. It was expressed in an article called The Yin and Yang of HIV, A Great Future Behind It. And what was proposed was that there should be an adjudication of the HIV/AIDS controversy by a scientific jury of serious scientific minds who've been vetted for bias and investment and so forth. So like, you know, like physicists and the like, you know, just clever guys who could sit on a panel and adjudicate a debate. But what, so that was the idea, and that's how it began, and that's what Mbeki wanted. But in the implementation, somebody dropped the ball and left out the adjudication, the critical, the pivotal adjudication element of the thing, with the result that there was a kind of a moderator, something like Canadian law professor, whatever he was, you know, he was full of smiles and, you know, but it was useless. I was so pissed off, actually. I mean, I was central to this whole thing politically, but I was so pissed off by this that I nearly didn't go. But then I got this, Resnick phoned me, actually. He said, listen, man, you got to come. And so I jumped in my car and I shot straight up to Pretoria and I had a cool dinner and, you know, met all the people. It was wonderful, actually. But it was, the thing was blown. Nonetheless, at the second meeting, the participants broke up into groups, as is quite common at these big symposia, colloquiums, and broke up into groups, and Eleni Papadopoulos and Turner were part of a group that resolved to hold, to conduct the isolation experiment. In other words, following all the accepted protocols for the isolation of viruses, as odd as it sounds, this is going to be done in respect of HIV. It was resolved, it was minuted, it was never done. And so, I don't know, the guy, because, you know, again, he's a friendly guy, and you know, he stayed at my house a few days, and I know him well. But Harvey Bialy flew out. He was chat with Duisberg, and editor of Nature Biotechnology. Anyway, he flew out, and he did like a half-assed experiment that blew up. It all went wrong. But the isolation experiment that was resolved and minuted was never conducted. So ultimately, it was just a talking shop, and finally, a failure.
The reality is that he's getting old. Is he going to be vindicated before he dies?
Okay. So, remember I told you, Jim, remember I told you that I'd written this book, and I sent it up to government in manuscript.
What's it called? AZT.
Debating AZT. It was then subtitled Questions of Safety and Utility. Yeah, it's free online. It's on the website, tig.org.za. It's now called Mbeki and the AIDS Drug Controversy because it not only did it canvas all the key scientific literature at the time, published at the time, it also dealt with some of the political maelstrom around the thing. But after that, I thought to myself, you know, this thing has got much bigger than this bad drug. It's really all about the HIV theory of AIDS and that whole thing. So I then began writing, well, like I said earlier, this is the this is the galley proof for editing. It's a bit dog-eared now, like 1,000 pages. I have captured every single thing Mbeki ever wrote or said about recorded, said and what was recorded about HIV and AIDS, and I've written up with, you know, quoting all his detractors and so forth. And the original title of this book, which is Just Say Yes, Mr. President, and Begging AIDS, quoting a terribly stupid Mail and Guardian headline article, Just Say Yes, Mr. President. I mean, how ridiculous. But the original title of the manuscript was In the President's Defense. And the intention was to be, the intention was that the book would serve as a kind of a, as an advocate's brief. It was, you know, being an advocate and all myself. It was meant to be his case, finally expressed comprehensively, because, you know, there were just bits and pieces all over the place. And here I pulled it all together and wrote it up. So when you say, will he be vindicated? Well, the book sure does tell a story, and he comes out shining. But, you know, bad scientific ideas are very difficult to overcome and dislodge. And it's been, I think Goethe remarked that that science proceeds by the deaths, the deaths of exponents of bad ideas, you know. So let's be frank. Virology, the viral theory of disease, remains very strongly regnant in our time. It's at no risk of being dislodged anytime soon. Bobby Kennedy Jr., Robert Kennedy Jr., as you know, wrote this nice book called The Real Anthony Fauci. And it's apparently a million copy seller. It's like huge. He quotes my second book, The Trouble with Nevirapine, 8 times. I was quite happy to see that. He cites it. But the trouble with with Kennedy's book is that he touches on the Perth Group critique, but doesn't embrace it. And the book is basically written from the perspective of, as regards HIV/AIDS, from the Duisbergian position, which is that, you know, HIV is harmless. It's like not all it's cracked up to be, which again, like I said, it's like a toothless vampire critique. It's no good. To answer, so I'm talking round and about here, but will Mbeki ever be vindicated? Well, everybody's forgotten about AZT, you know. It's been replaced by other drugs. Some English guy in England just emailed me out the blue, and he told me the drug he's on, you know, very different from AZT. It's kind of like out of fashion. It's like gone out. All I can say is that the record supports Mbeki's decisions and justifies Mbeki's intervention. But it'll take a long time before it's widely recognized that he was right.
And just to point out, because we haven't mentioned it, but in his 2001 AIDS report, on page 18, they speak about the problems with, wait for it, PCR tests.
Yeah. No, that's right, man. I mean, the whole
COVID. Déjà vu. Haven't we met before?
Yeah, exactly. You know, when this COVID thing began, I mean, immediately, being like a truth-seeking type, immediately I hunted out the founding papers, you know, by the Chinese. You know, I pulled them off the net. I saw they were just like complete bullshit. They were so bad. I mean, I could see, it's like a school teacher reading like a really bad essay, you know, full of mistakes. And I could see what rubbish this was. Nonetheless, you know, next thing, the whole world was in a lockdown. So as you say, deja vu, and all based on PCR. Well, we could talk for hours about what's wrong with PCR. Even as you know, I'm sure your other two speakers have mentioned this, Mullis himself, you know, repudiated his technology that he invented as a diagnostic tool.
You're standing as a soldier on the battleground of the information war, and you're looking out at the horizon. What do you see?
Okay. I was actually thinking about this earlier. You know, When I began this thing, I imagined that AZT, the marketing of AZT was some kind of a terrible, exceptional aberration, and that medicine had gone badly wrong in this particular instance, and that it could be remedied by, you know, determined, let's say, frankly, political action, activism, like mine. But I've come to understand that the whole of Western medicine is fundamentally corrupt. It's fundamentally misconceived. It's like inherently perverse, you know. And you know, you look away from AZT, which is a particularly egregious, you know, drug. But then you look at other drugs and you discover that any number of drugs on the market, which are currently being ingested, you know, are also very, very bad and very toxic. So what do I see? I don't know. I see the thing rolling on. I'll tell you frankly, I'm making no great claim here. In fact, I'm conceding that we were defeated. You know? I mean, I tell you, man, I put every nerve and sinew for years into this, you know, being engagé with this problem. I really put everything in. I mean, it really, part of my time and energy, like sucked out so much of my life force, you know. But we were defeated because the forces were just too powerful. I mean, you know, we haven't mentioned the TAC, but that's millions, you know, more than they conceded, like much more than they could even spend, you know, showered millions of from funders abroad. And, you know, with all their assets in the media. So it was a very difficult struggle. And I did what I could. But when COVID hit, I looked into it and then I just backed right off because I just knew this thing just had to like burn itself out as HIV/AIDS did. By the way, as syphilis did, I mentioned that earlier, syphilis is completely absent from the public consciousness today. No one thinks, well, I get syphilis, you know, if meet someone new, you know, go over someone new. But there was one, at one time, everybody worried about syphilis, you know, and used to swallow and used to get injected with arsenic. Look at this. See this? Arsenic ampules, you know. I mean, today, any doctor who injected anybody with arsenic would be arrested for attempted murder or murder and locked up with a criminally insane, you know.
If I wanted to follow your work, how would I do that?
Everything you need is at tig.org.za. Yeah. I should underscore that I'm kind of retired from the field, so to say, because I'm involved in another colossal project. But I don't even start talking about it now. It's a big corruption matter. But and a lot of litigation around it. So that's what consumes me now. But everything I've done is published at tig.org.za. All my books there are free. All my articles, all my open letters, free. I never wrote for a dime. I mean, I did it in the public interest.
Anthony Brink, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
No, thanks, Jim.
My name is Jim. This is Jim Warfare, the Battle of Ideas.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please visit supportjim.com.